Welcome to episode 6 of the Views from 314 Feet podcast on the Pictureless Podcast Network. As always, it's Randy Wilkins, and I'm joined by Yankees beat reporter from The Athletic, Chris Kirshner. Chris, how are you?
Doing great. Rainy day in New York, so that's no fun. Other than that, I booked my wedding venue.
Oh,
yeah.
Congrats.
Yeah, it's fun.
That's a big step.
Yeah, going to have it at the Bronx Zoo next year.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be dope. Fun. How you doing?
I'm trying to wake up. And
same.
We talked about it before we started recording. I don't know what's going on. I don't know if it's the weather. I don't know if it's like some work catching up to me. I don't know what's happening, but I'm like super sleepy. So I don't drink coffee, which apparently was like a big topic of conversation on Twitter yesterday because Bill Belichick mentioned that he's never had a cup of coffee, and neither have I. I've never had coffee. I've had two sips in my whole life. So I drank some tea to give me some like jolt of adrenaline and then or energy, whatever. And hopefully gets me through this podcast with no issue so I don't like fall asleep on us or something like that.
It's funny. I also like don't drink coffee, which is like a cardinal sin for sports writers because we're working late nights and never drink coffee. I have, like, I would occasionally, but, like, only lattes. So, basically.
Oh, wow, just, the fancy stuff.
Basically just milk.
Yeah.
but I won't drink, like, a regular cup of coffee. I've never had a regular cup of coffee. I don't like the taste. I think it tastes nasty.
That's why I
prefer the lattes because like you can actually it's tastier because it's, you know, it's mostly milk.
Yeah, it's funny because my mom was a teacher. She's retired now and could not function like I feel like every other teacher in America without her morning coffee. That was like it was a necessity. Like brush your teeth, wash your face, take a shower, all that like necessary hygiene stuff, and then have coffee. And if she didn't have coffee, then it was like an issue. And I feel a lot of that was tied to her being a teacher. She doesn't nearly drink as much coffee now as she did when she was working. And I tried her coffee like once or twice and I was like, this is disgusting. I'm never doing this again.
Neither of my parents drink coffee. So I guess it just passed down to me too. I think it was maybe 2 or 3-ish years ago. I had like my first like actual like full latte. I was like, all right. Yeah. I mean, it tastes good, but like the regular coffee stuff, hell no.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't drink alcohol either. I've never had a full glass of alcohol in my life either. So I don't know what's going on with that, but I just don't drink any of that stuff.
just water.
Well, more than water, but I'll drink soda. So like that's just as bad in some cases as
it is. Yes,
as alcohol. But I don't drink a ton of soda. There was a stretch. Okay, so this was stupid, and this is you being a teenager or me being a teenager. I would play basketball all day, and the pizza shop near my house would sell $1 2-liter sodas. So instead of drinking water or like being responsible as a kid, I would just buy 2-liter sodas every day, like a total idiot, and knock those back. But I don't drink nearly as much soda as I did when I was younger. So, like, you know, tea, iced tea, water, try to keep it simple, try to be semi health conscious from time to time. So, but I'm awake now since we've talked about this. So I'm
ready to go.
All right, so the Yankees just wrapped up a very boring series in Toronto. And obviously, they didn't win the series. They came back in the 9th of the final game to salvage the series and have a pretty impressive comeback victory. But overall, I found the series to be very boring and kind of uninteresting in a lot of ways. I think that series is a microcosm of the idea that it's a long baseball season. I think they just didn't win the games. You know, one game, the other guy pitched really well. And in the second game, they just didn't score enough runs. You know, it's what's going to happen in a game of baseball. So I don't think there's anything too alarming or anything to really like extrapolate from those games that made me feel like, they're going in a different direction. Or some people were saying like the pumpkin showed up, which I totally disagree with. I think it's just baseball. But what were your thoughts on the Toronto series?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It was incredibly boring. You know, before the eighth inning in Wednesday's game, before Soto hit the home run, like nothing really had happened offensively for the Yankees. And then obviously in the ninth, they, you know, had an outburst and ended up winning the game. But like, there aren't really major takeaways in this series, I feel like. I do feel like the offense specifically, you know, when Soto hit his homer, I started at like calculating some stats of just like, you know, who's doing what for the Yankees offensively, because for the most part, it's really been three guys on offense for the Yankees this season who've really carried them. That's Soto, Anthony Volpe, and Oswaldo Cabrera. So far for the season, Soto, Volpe, Cabrera are a combined 64 for 194 at the plate. That's a .330 average. 9 homers, 38 RBIs. Now, everyone else on the Yankees, that includes Judge, Stanton, who's been good, you know, and everybody who's gotten in that batch, John Birdie, Trent Grisham, they're combined 91 for 434. That's a .210 average, 12 homers, 44 RBIs. But what was interesting is before that ninth inning in Wednesday's game, the three guys, Soto, Volpe, Cabrera, had 2 fewer RBIs than everybody else on the Yankees and just 2 fewer home runs. I don't know how sustainable that is. I mean, it's obviously not sustainable one way or the other. Some guys are going to emerge because Judge is in the group with everybody else. You know, I expect him to do Judgian things at some point. Gleyber Torres has been terrible. I still expect him to come alive at some point. Like, I don't think he's a bad player now. You know, he was really good last year, and he was one of the, you know, two best hitters that the Yankees had alongside Judge. So I expect him to come alive. You know, we've talked about Rizzo a bunch. I don't know what to expect with him. Stan's in that group. You know, it's encouraging that he's been, you know, he's legitimately been good. But the thing with Stanton is like, you have kind of been conditioned over the past couple of years to expect him to, one, the major thing with Stanton is get hurt. And two, you never know with Stanton if this is just a hot streak or is this sustainable? Is he going to be a 140 plus WRC plus player moving forward? I don't know. I would say I would lean toward no, just because of what we've seen in the past 2 years. I do think that some of his swing changes that he made in the offseason feel like they've been paying off. Like, he's pulling the ball much more than he had in previous years. And, you know, I know some of the, like, the old-timey Yankees fans are like, don't pull the ball, you know, hit it to right field, we need singles. You know, like that doesn't win games. Like, hitting the ball in the air to your pull side wins games. I know it's, you know, some people don't want to like look at the analytics and the metrics and they don't believe in that stuff, but like that's legit. Like, if Stanton would hit the ball in the air more often toward left field, he would be a monster. And he's done that so far, and that's partly why he's, you know, been good. But again, with Stanton, you just never know when it's going to crumble down. So I think the offense, you know, we can get into it more if you'd like, but, you know, it is interesting that three guys have been carrying this team, and two of them you didn't really expect that from, with Volpe and Cabrera. Maybe Volpe to some degree, but, you know, just judging off of statistics alone last year, I don't think anybody would have expected him to be, you know, one of the 25 best hitters in baseball so far.
Yeah, I definitely think this is something that we should dig into for a bit, because the offense is a little confounding to me. And I'm not sure if I even mean that in a positive or negative manner. It's just, it's interesting. I mean, because there are a lot of good things that's happening throughout the lineup. And then there are stats like the ones that you presented that kind of show, not concern, but show that there's room for improvement and that they really aren't clicking yet, which if you look at the names and the back of the baseball cards, as they like to say, I think that probably bodes well for the future. I think Soto is going to be great all season. I mean, that's his standard. So I think that the expectations make sense there. We've talked about Volpe a bunch. I think this is legitimate. I don't think he's going to now, obviously he's not going to probably play at this insane level for the entire season. And in the series against Toronto, we saw him kind of slide a bit. He was one of their least productive hitters, I think, in that series.
Yep.
Which makes sense. I mean, there's going to be some market correction there. He was playing insane for any player. But I think that he'll be a regular contributor. I think that if this keeps going on, which I think it will, he'll be in consideration for an all-star selection, all those things. So I expect Volpe to continue to play well. Cabrera looks legit so far. It's early, but I just think the quality of his at-bats would suggest that he could be an average contributor offensively as the season goes on at worst. We'll see what happens when LeMahieu comes back and all that stuff and if this is sustainable for him. But I feel like his changes are also significant and feel way more legitimate than they have been in this first 2 years with the Yankees. So when you have Judge not hitting as well, Glaber not hitting as well, you would think that moving on, that stat and those stats that you presented would kind of correct itself. So I think that that's a positive because the three guys, I think, have a good case to say that they'll keep this type of production moving forward. The thing that I find interesting is the emphasis on having good quality at bats and grinding at bats. And we've talked about this a little bit, but now that there's some more data popping up, I've searched a little bit on Baseball Savant. And what I found is that their chase percentage is the best in the league. So they're not like going out of the zone much. They're not really swinging at many pitches, as people like to say. They've had really good discipline at bats, and I think that passes the eye test. We can see that from game to game. The thing that's on the flip side, though, is that they're last in swing percentage by at least 2 percentage points with the next team ahead of them or above them, which is Milwaukee, who I don't think any of us confused with some offensive juggernaut. So I'm curious if part of the reason why the offense feels inconsistent or it kind of has these starts and stops, or you get to a certain part of the lineup and they're not as productive as other parts of the lineup, might just be because they're not swinging enough. You know, they have these good at bats. I'm pretty sure they lead the league in pitches seen per plate appearance. If mm-hmm. not, they're like top five. But I think they're the top team also in that category. But they're not swing. They're, to me, you have those types of at-bats so you get pitches to crush, not to just walk, even though certain sports talk radio personalities – have issues when people do take walks, but we won't get into that. But you craft these at bats so you put yourself in a position to do damage because you're forcing the pitchers to come into the zone and give you a better pitch to hit. But as we see with some of these statistics and some of the metrics, they're not really taking advantage of those moments if and when they present themselves. So it seems like interesting. And then one other stat that stood out to me, which is also one of my favorite stats on Baseball Savant, which is meatball percentage. I just love that there's some like baseball parlance here. They're also dead last in meatball percentage. So they're like, when they do get these pitches, they're not doing as much damage up and down the lineup when those pitches do present themselves. And again, I think that passes the eye test. I know Aaron Judge has talked about missing these fastballs. I feel like Stanton's missed some meatballs. Glaber has. You can see it during the game. So the offense is, it's early, of course. So this will play itself out as time goes on. But it's really interesting to me that the one thing that they were like really conscious of focusing on going into the season, which is really working at bats and grinding at bats as opposed to last year when they didn't do anything well, it almost feels like they're kind of going to the extreme only in the sense that when they do get pitches, they're not driving them. They're not making like great contact. And they're also middle to low to the bottom end of the pack in slugging, as we've mentioned before. So they're interesting at this
point. Yeah. I mean, I think for the lack of slugging, I mean, we can point to, you know, Judge hasn't gotten going. Rizzo hasn't gotten going. Torres hasn't gotten going. So there are three like major guys who you would expect damage to be done, and they just haven't really done much damage. You know, we've talked about Rizzo's lack of barrels. You know, I think he just had his first barrel of the season in this Toronto series, and we're what, 16 games in? If, what are they, 12 in? What's their record?
They're 13-7, so they've played 20 games.
20
or
games.
13-6. I'm
13. No,
they played 19.
Yeah, that's right.
They played 19 games.
All the games are running together.
Yeah, we're already at that point.
But I think for the Yankees, you know, I think one of the main things they wanted to improve on from last season was getting on base. You know, they just didn't get on base a lot last year. Now this year they're third so far in on base percentage. And that a lot of that is because they're walking a lot and they're taking pitches. And like you mentioned, they're grinding at bats and they are getting on base. So I think for the Yankees, I think that does bode well, like moving forward, just because you do expect the hitters who usually produce to actually produce at some point. So if they can, you know, combine them getting on base, which they've done a really good job of, with the slugging, with the home runs, you know, I do think that this offense could be really, really good. Because right now, I'm looking now, they're 10th in home runs and slugging, they are 12th in the league. I would expect both of those numbers would rise at some point. You know, I wouldn't be stunned if it's, you know, May 18th and the Yankees are, you know, top 3 to 5 in home runs and top 3 to 5 in slugging. I would expect that to rise. So I think if that does, we're kind of looking at a good total package for the Yankees with them getting on base, being able to drive the ball and scoring runs. You know, that's obviously the name of the game. So I think confounding was the right word to use, the word you use to describe this offense, because it is a little weird right now, but I do think over time the numbers will sort themselves out and the Yankees will be near the top of the leaderboard in the categories you want them to be.
And I think another positive, I agree with you. I think another positive, even though it might not feel like it because they hit into so many double plays when they have guys on base, but they're doing well ground ball percentage wise too. They're not just beating the ball into the ground. I think they're top 10 in ground ball percentage so far, which is something that I've been conscious of, not necessarily like digging into the numbers all the time, but always kind of checking on over the last couple of years, because it definitely seemed like that was a trend that was going in the wrong direction over the last couple of seasons. And so far they've been pretty good about correcting that. And I know that sounds weird because they hit into way too many double plays. I mean, I know that they get a lot of guys on base, but, and so the chances of a double play happening obviously rise just because you have more base runners, but it just seems like they have a curse with these double plays. But overall, surprisingly, they're not hitting the ball on the ground too much compared to the rest of the league. It's always interesting because when you have a team that really focuses on working at bats, like a Boston or Houston, you know, the teams that you would think and normally over the years connect to good, strong offenses, there's always this delicate balance of striking patience with power, or patience with aggressiveness might be a better way to put it. And I still feel like they're trying to figure out the aggressiveness part. You know, there's just even with Judge, I know that he says that he's missing fastballs, but I also think there's some pitches that he's just like letting go by as well. And I think that that's true for a couple other guys. Gleyber, I think, is in his own category. I think when I'm talking about the lineup, I'm putting Gleyber in his own space because I think Gleyber is pressing. I think a lot of this, just his overall play, strikes me as someone that's pressing for multiple reasons. And Gleyber has always struck me as not necessarily an outwardly emotional player, but I think that he's an emotional player when it comes to like overall circumstance. And I think sometimes you can see when something's bothering him or when he's like affected by something. So Gleyber to the side, and maybe we can talk about Gleyber a little bit more, but it just feels like because it's early and there was that emphasis on, you know, getting on base, as you mentioned, I think they're just trying to figure out their way of how do we merge the two things together. So when we get later into the season, they're like really humming and being able to do both. And I do think when I talk about like the lack of swing percentage, it's not a criticism. It's just an observation of what's going on. So I do think that being able to establish a foundation where they can get on base a lot and they're driving these pitch counts and having really competitive at bats, at bat to at bat and batter to batter, ultimately will serve them well, because you'd rather have that early on than just hitting a bunch of home runs and being like reckless at the plate. So I think it's going in the right direction. But I think at some point they're going to have to be a little bit more aggressive.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You mentioned Judge, like I'm looking at some numbers now. He has the lowest swing percentage of his career so far, 38.7%. The second lowest was 2018, 40.3%. Out of the pitches that he's seen inside the strike zone, 66% swing percentage. That's the lowest since 2018 as well. So yeah, I mean, I with Judge in particular, like I think it's great that he's getting on base. You know, I think he's still leading the league, or he's up there in walks. But with Judge, you want him to swing the bat, because when he swings the bat, out of everybody in the league, he has the best chance of hitting a home run, and that's always the best outcome for any hitter. So you want Judge to at least be a little bit more aggressive at the plate. I think it's interesting though, you know, he has been one of the best fastball hitters in the sport really since his, you know, official rookie season. Like he's always crushed fastballs. And, you know, Aaron Boone mentioned after the game, I think it was Monday's game, either Monday or Tuesday's game, that he hasn't been crushing fastballs. He's actually been bad with fastballs. So Boone was correct with that. It's by far the worst year that he's ever had with fastballs. I don't know if that's, you know, a lot of the times catching up to the fastball has everything to do with timing.
Right.
I know Judge wants to say that, you know, not playing the 8 to 10 days in spring has nothing to do with it. He's never going to admit that, even if that's the case. But, you know, I think it is an easy thing to point to that he is still trying to work on his timing. You know, it's still early in the season where, you know, not everybody across the league is, you know, grooving. And obviously Judge is one of those guys who's not in a groove yet. But maybe it is the truth that, you know, missing that 8 to 10 days in spring where he was mid-spring beat up is you know, is affecting him now, 20 games into the season. But again, I don't know. I'm just throwing out a theory because, you know, Judge says that it's not a timing thing related to spring training. But again, he's never going to admit that. But it is an interesting thing to note that he is struggling so much with fastballs, and fastballs are just usually strictly a timing pitch.
Yeah, I don't think we're ever going to let go of a mid-spring training beat up, because that's just a great phrase. But I'm going to be
mid-spring beat up when, you know, it's my fifth trip of the season, and I'm on the West Coast and San Diego next month. You know,
yeah, and then people will constantly ask you if you're hurt or not every time you drop a new article on The Athletic.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I think it's legit. Like, you know, I do think that it's possible that he is still trying to get his timing down. And once Judge gets his timing down, as we've seen, he's a monster.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all timing. There might be like a little mechanical thing that's going on too, that could be minor. Because I think fastballs will expose somebody's mechanics pretty quickly, you know, if there's something that's off. I think that normally happens when guys are not really hitting the fastball well. So there could be a little mechanical thing that goes along with it too. But I mean, we both believe that he's healthy. I mean, I don't think this has anything to do with health. I think it's strictly like baseball stuff and baseball related. Yeah. And it feels like timing. I don't know. I have no real concerns about the offense. I mean, I just feel like, you know, some guys started off hot and some guys aren't, and eventually they'll catch up to it. There was one other stat that I thought was interesting to note before we go to break, and that's the Yankees are second in whiff percentage in the entire league, which is really encouraging. And if they can somehow keep that level of discipline, and I guess part of it is contact too. I mean, we talked a little bit about the contact rates and percentage. So it could just be that they're just not swinging at bad pitches as much as they did in the past. But to have that low of a whiff percentage relative to the league is really encouraging. That'll probably go up once they start making better swing choices and decisions as the season goes on. But I think there's a lot of underlying stuff that looks good that should have Yankees fans excited for what's to come once some other things start clicking and they start making adjustments. So I know that there's frustration with the offense just because you look at all the names and there's obviously naturally an expectation to just see these guys go off right from day one. And quite honestly, I felt the same way. I'm a fan just like everybody else. I felt like they were just going to smash everybody from game one to game 162. But that probably wasn't realistic. But when you actually look at the numbers and dig deep into it, there's a lot of positive things going on. And again, this is happening without some of their big boys really getting going. So I think there are positives that people can rely on and kind of place their eyes on to say, okay, this is going to start to come around hopefully sooner than later. So
I agree with you. I think the offense is totally fine. You know, it is interesting though, just, you know, some of the stats that we've discussed. But I think in the long term, the Yankees are going to have one of the best offenses in the sport.
Yeah, I agree. So with that, we'll come back after this break. Maybe we'll talk a little Glaber. We'll talk a little pitching. We'll find out what we're going to talk about when we get back from this break. Welcome back to the Views from 314 Feet podcast on the Pitcherless Podcast Network. It's Randy, it's Chris. And we want to talk a little bit about Gleyber Torres. We know that he's been a lightning rod in Yankees land since the season started. He's always kind of been a divisive figure over the years. There was a stretch where I myself was very critical of Gleyber. I never thought that Gleyber was a shortstop. I don't think that move should have ever been made. it happened. He didn't play well, and then he bounced back. And I've converted back to being one of his biggest supporters. I think Gleyber's a really good baseball player. I think he's one of the best second basemen in the league. Admittedly, he's not playing like that right now. But I'm a fan of Gleyber. I think he's an important piece to this team, and I think he'll show that as the season goes on. But to be honest, he's been their worst player besides Anthony Rizzo. I don't think there are many positives to look at so far with Gleyber to start the season. Kind of hurts me to say that, but it's the truth. And because of that, a lot of people are piling on him right now that it's justified to a certain degree. But it just feels like Gleyber is in the mix almost every game and like not in a good way. And something we can talk about is play, but there's something that you mentioned on a previous episode that I'd actually like to talk about a little bit more with Gleyber, which is that he wasn't available to talk to you guys in the locker room after some of the games. So I want to get to that as well, but let's just talk about his play on the field. Obviously he hasn't played well. What do you think's been contributing to that? What are your thoughts about Gleyber so far? What have you seen, even being at the games? Does the team have concerns about him? What have you seen with Gleyber?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the team, they're just like never going to say they have a concern about anybody. You know, Boone said the other day, I'll read the quote, "Offensively, I don't worry about Gleyber. But this many games in, we're all human. You want to get results. He's just too talented of a hitter to be held down." You know, I think for him, there's so much at stake for him this season with a large contract waiting for him in December or whenever he ends up signing in the offseason. The fact that this might be his last year in the Bronx, he's made it very clear that he wants to be with the Yankees. But, you know, when you look at the payroll situation, the amount of money that they're likely going to have to commit to Soto, I don't think Gleyber is going to be back with the Yankees next year. That's not me reporting anything, but just looking at it from a financial standpoint, you know, if the Yankees want to improve the roster or they want to, you know, shed payroll somewhere, you know, letting Gleyber walk and filling his spot would be the obvious choice. I think just from talking with Gleyber over the past couple of years now, I think he kind of realizes that he might be the odd man out. And you just never know how that could impact someone's head, like their mental state. And I do think that could definitely be playing a role here. You know, he's definitely making a lot of money this year, but you know, every player approaches free agency different. You know, we saw Judge have one of the best seasons in modern baseball history before he became a free agent. But there are also so many examples of a player letting the pressure of getting a nine-figure contract get in their way. Again, I don't think it's anything to, you know, say definitively like this is the reason why Gleyber is struggling. But you do wonder for sure, you know, because the results just have been so poor. Like there's not really anything encouraging when you're looking at his profile that says, oh, okay, like, yeah, he's getting unlucky. Like Austin Wells, he's been very unlucky. You can point to Austin Wells and say, wow, like if you look at his numbers, like that guy's going to break out at some point. Right. He's not going to just hit into bad luck the entire season. Whereas with Gleyber, it's like, I don't really know what to point to say, like, all right, like he's on the verge. And that's what Boone has been saying for the past couple of days, like when we've been asking about Gleyber and, you know, what makes you believe that he's going to get going. And like, he doesn't really point to anything specifically to say like, oh yeah, like he's actually like he's hitting the ball hard, or, you know, he's had a string of like seven batted balls where like they were just rockets and they just ended up, you know, being hit to someone. Like it's not really the case. So I don't really know what to say about him. You know, he's still getting on base because he's walking. You know, he's not chasing pitches. I think it also just goes back to what I was saying with Judge. You know, Gleyber is a really good bat, and he's dangerous when he's on. And he's just not swinging the bat, you know, as often as he did last season. Maybe being more aggressive would help him, because, you know, sometimes you can just run into one if you are more aggressive. So maybe he can try that, but there's really nothing that I can say definitively as to like why he's struggling or, you know, is he close? I don't think he's close. You know, I do think that Gleyber's one of those guys that if he's struggling at the plate, I do think it bleeds into how he's playing in the field. I think we saw that in the Cleveland series and in this series too with some plays. I just think like, you can tell when Gleyber's down on himself or upset. You can hear it in his voice. I think he's an emotional player. Nothing wrong with that. But, you know, sometimes I do think that he needs to rein it in a little bit. But, yeah, it's a difficult one to discuss because I don't really have any answers.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that there's no real – trend line suggests to me even more that it's a mental emotional thing, and we'll never be able to properly quantify that or definitively say that that's what it is, because he's not going to tell us that for obvious reasons. But it just feels like a guy who wanted to start off strong out of the gate for reasons that go beyond just winning some baseball games and trying to turn the page on the Yankees season from last year. You know, it's just across the board, it's just not good baseball play. And I totally agree that I do think his frustration at the plate bleeds into his performance in the field. I will say that I'm always bothered when people say he has a low IQ. That is not true. Gleyber Torres knows how to play professional baseball. He is not a low IQ player. I think there are bouts of focus issues, and I think sometimes he's aggressive at the wrong time. And I think he tries to make plays happen, and either he's not athletic enough to just make a play happen, or it probably isn't the right time to do something. Like even the play when he fielded the ground ball in Toronto and threw to third base. That was a very good baseball play. He didn't have a play at first base just because of where his body was. And he got off a good throw. And really that play wasn't an out because of Oswaldo's positioning, not because of anything that Gleyber did. So I do not buy, and I vehemently disagree with this prevailing notion that Gleyber's some low IQ player. Like, that bothers me. I think that there's other things that go into that that we don't have to discuss right now. When people talk about Gleyber, but again, he's not playing well. And it just feels like the overall quality of play, it just feels like he's trying to, we said this before, he's trying to hit a 10 run home run at the plate. And he's trying to like turn an unassisted triple play whenever there's a ground ball to him. You know what I mean? Like it just feels like there's a lot happening with every play that Gleyber's involved in right now. And this is really a conversation for down the road. I think he should be a Yankee moving forward. I think that if the Yankees were unable to spend big money this offseason in the free agency market, in my opinion, there's no excuse not to bring Soto and Torres back. Like, you had $300 million earmarked for Yamamoto. You didn't spend a third of that or close to a third of that in free agency. Like, you should be able to make it happen. You know, I'll kind of be like a meathead fan here and say, if you can't bring both of them back, like, that's on the organization, not because you didn't have the money. You haven't spent free agency dollars like that. Like,
yeah, I mean, they definitely have the money to spend.
Yeah, yeah.
They have the money to do whatever they want. But right, as we've seen, that they don't operate that way.
No, I agree. I mean, even in that context, like, even mm-hmm. in their like fiscally responsible approach to player acquisition, I don't think it's – I don't buy that they can't bring both of those guys back. You didn't spend – you spent $30 million on Marcus Stroman. That's all you did, basically. And, like, little pieces here and there. And, like, you know, you didn't even bring Wandy back. You got Gonzalez and Caleb Ferguson in trades. Like, you didn't spend the money that you earmarked for a guy who deserved to get a contract in Yamamoto. Like, I don't know. We could talk. I think we can talk about it later. But
yeah, I mean, I think for that specifically, they obviously value players at different dollar amounts. You know, just because I saw it a lot with, you know, with Blake Snell. You know, oh, like they were willing to spend $300 million for Yamamoto, so why can't they spend $200 million on Blake Snell? Well, because they didn't think he's a $200 million pitcher. You don't just give money out to someone when you don't believe they're worth that dollar amount. You know, they thought Yamamoto was worth $300 million. They were comfortable spending $300 million. They were not comfortable spending $200 million on Snell. And then for Glaber, they probably have a dollar amount that they'd be comfortable with. And if it exceeds that, then they're probably going to walk away, because they probably look at the situation and say there are other second basemen that we can fill his spot, whether you agree or disagree with that thinking. You know, I certainly think that Glaber is worthy of an extension and re-signing him in free agency. An extension is not happening. Right. But, you know, signing him in free agency this winter, I certainly think they should do that. And they certainly have the money to do so. It's whether or not they believe that money could go to someone else, or they feel like that money could be better used elsewhere, which we don't know, because, you know, we're in April right now and things could change.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm not saying Glaber should get a $300 million contract.
Yeah,
I'm
for sure.
I'm just saying. Glaber has, we don't know what their valuation of Glaber is, but from the outside looking in compared to other players and his impact on this team, when he's right, it's probably not the best time to like advocate for Glaber getting a contract now, because he's stinking it up. And I acknowledge that, but I think he's going to play to his level at some point. It just feels like the value is appropriate for a top five second baseman, and to not have that value on him would be kind of odd to me. I mean, I don't, especially second base. I don't, there aren't that many good or elite second basemen in the league right now. I mean, one of them's getting older in Altuve, you know what I mean? So it just, I don't know. Glaber is always an interesting topic of conversation, regardless of where we are in the year, or if we're talking about his play on the field or he should come back. It's just, I don't even know how we got to this point with Glaber, you know, like how he's kind of like this lightning rod. I guess it started with the move to shortstop in the pandemic season and the rocket ball disappearing, and all the adjustments he had to make, and he had some injuries. And I think he was one of the players where the pandemic like really kind of messed them up physically. I know he came into camp, that like weird camp in July or June or whatever it was, and he was out of shape, but it was a pandemic. I get it, like totally different world at the time. But he's kind of evolved into this like really divisive figure amongst Yankees fans. And I don't know exactly when that happened, but I'm guessing it's when he made the move to shortstop.
Yeah. I mean, cause he was bad.
He was terrible. Yeah.
He was really bad. And he shouldn't have been there in the first place.
Totally.
But also, you know, hitting 38 home runs in 2019 when, you know, if you look at the home run leaderboard that year, just across baseball, it's hilarious because there's so many weird guys who hit like over 30 homers. And then, you know, anytime you do that, fans are going to like freak out and, you know, like this guy is, you know, he's special, or he's really good, or, you know, we need to pay him, or whatever it might be. That definitely leads to expectations. I think we talked about it in the last episode with Harrison Bader. He hits like 5 home runs in the playoffs. Everybody's freaking out saying, you need to sign this guy long term. give him $100 million or whatever. And it turns out like he wasn't really that good. He's not that great right. of a player. So with Gleyber, I think the expectations were so high, you know, hitting 38 home runs, and then, you know, he takes a big hit to his image with playing shortstop. You know, you mentioned the pandemic season wasn't really good. 21, not that great. And then, you know, 22, he
got benched was, in 22 at the beginning.
Yeah, he didn't play. He didn't start. He was he came off the bench opening day, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
But he still had a good season. But, you know, last year it was like, okay, like this is legit, because, you know, the at least from what we know, the ball isn't as crazy as it was in 2019. So, right. I mean, he just had like an up and down Yankee career. So anytime like that happens, I feel like it's those players tend to be divisive around amongst the fan base.
Yeah, for sure. Hopefully for the Yankees and for Gleyber, he'll start snapping out of it soon, because I think, you know, we talked a lot about the offense. If he gets going, that definitely elevates this lineup. And the defense needs to be better. I mean, the infield defense altogether needs to be better. I mean, the infield defense is terrible. We haven't talked about it that much, but just as a collective, it's just been outside of Volpe, who also has three errors. But I mean, you kind of take that when you're making plays up the middle, like he did on Vladdy's ground ball yesterday. The infield defense just needs to get better. And I hope it will. You know, I would expect it to, but it's also been really bad. You know what I mean?
They're 19th in outs above average in the infield. But Boone says he's not concerned.
Well, if Aaron Boone's not concerned, then I won't be concerned, because as everybody knows, I roll with Aaron Boone wherever Aaron Boone goes.
it's never a concern. But never, yeah, they're 19th right now. It's not great, but again, Rizzo's been weird. Torres, he is what he is. Volpe's been special. He's been really good. Yeah. You know, he has the three errors. I think those are all, if I remember correctly, throwing. I think they were all throwing errors. Oswaldo's been pretty bad, honestly, defensively. He had a really good game in Wednesday's. I think it was Wednesday. He had a couple of like really nice plays where he dove for the ball, and I think it was Wednesday's game. He had that like weird hop against Vlad. Ended up like saving two runs. I think that was actually Tuesday's game. Yeah. But yeah, he hasn't been that great. I expect that when DJ comes back, the defense should get better, whether that's at third or first, because he can play both. I don't expect him to play second much, just with his age, his foot concerns. You don't want him up the middle.
No. I mean, I oddly got into a back and forth with someone that I didn't want to have about DJ playing second base. And it's like, he's however old he is with two recent foot issues. I mean, I don't think that that's a viable option unless it's an emergency. I mean, I think he's a corner guy at this point, which is fine. I mean, he's a good defender on the corners. Mm-hmm. So, I don't think he should see second base. I mean, that's an opportunity for Oswaldo to move around and, mm-hmm. kind of like, I mean, you already have a middle infield utility guy in Oswaldo. You don't really need to put LeMahieu there unless you're in a bind. So, I think he'll help the corner defense when he gets back, whenever that is. So we'll head to break. We'll come back. We'll talk a little bit about Luis Gil. We'll talk a little bit about Carlos Rodon, and then we'll wrap it up. But let's go to this break. Welcome back to the show. It's Randy. It's Chris. So we're just going to jump right into this with a very straightforward question. Luis Gil, is he a starter or is he a reliever?
I think long-term he's a reliever. And he'd be nasty out of the bullpen. But the problem with Luis, though, is like he just doesn't know where the ball is going. And I'm thinking about it from a hitter's perspective. That has to be so frightening, getting in the box with him.
Yep.
You know, he's throwing 100 miles an hour, and you have no clue where that ball is going to go. You know, most pitchers have an idea of like, all right, catcher setting up outside, that's where I'm throwing. I don't even think it matters where Trevino or Wells are setting up. That ball's just going to go where it goes.
Right.
I mean, he had 7 walks. It's crazy. He had 7 walks in Monday's game, and he still goes 5 innings, which is like, I don't even know how that's – I don't even know how the Blue Jays didn't score more runs against him and just didn't chase him earlier in the game. Like, his metrics are just absolutely insane. You know, I'm looking now. Opposing hitters are 2-for-25 against his fastball. They are 1-for-12 against his changeup. Like, I'm not even, like, exaggerating. Like, if he had any semblance of command, he would be one of the best pitchers in the sport. I mean, his stuff is ridiculous. He's allowed 0 barrels so far this year. His expected batting average against is 0.98. I mean, it's ridiculous. Yeah. But again, like, this is who Heel has been, like, even coming up through the minors. Like, he's never been known to, you know, have pristine command. You know, that's kind of been his MO. He's a fireballer. He's very difficult to hit, but you just don't know where the ball is going. So he's frustrating in that way, because like when you think about just his potential, you know, you can envision him at the top of any starting rotation across the sport, but you know, I don't know if he's ever going to get his command locked in. 'Cause if he does, you know, again, we're talking about someone who you could pair him right alongside Garrett Cole at the top of your rotation. That's how special he is.
I thought the Blue Jays start was hilarious because he was awful from pitch 1 to pretty much the last pitch. But the Blue Jays were almost kind of in self-defense. They were swinging in self-defense more than trying to, like, hit the baseball for production. You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, do you blame him? If you, yeah, if you no. had 100, yeah, yeah, I mean, no, if you I, had 100 mile an hour fastball coming at you, like, you're gonna be shitting your pants.
Yeah, and it was hilarious because the whole time I'm like, oh man, the Blue Jays should be killing him, and then I would see like Justin Turner swinging for his life just to avoid some like some rocket that's coming at him, and it was like, oh, that's why, you know, this game is close, is because they're fearful for their well-being for most of these at-bats. It's not like Heel is doing anything special. It's just they're petrified that they might get, like, their heads taken off by some fastball that the guy has no idea where it's going. So, yeah, it was funny because he was terrible in that Toronto game, but it's just, like, it's so tantalizing. You know, because like, I mean, you mentioned it and you gave us the stats. I mean, he's filthy. He's really talented. And I think because of that, that's why you try to be stubborn about it and see if he can stick in the rotation long term. I mean, the Yankees obviously have an idea of the point of no return where, you know, him being in the rotation just isn't productive for him or them. But if I'm part of the organization, that line is like kind of far down the road, because what if it does click, you know what I mean? Like you said, he's unhittable. You know, if you go him and Cole back to back, or like, you know, put somebody in the middle and then Heel pops up after you've seen Cole the day before. I mean, that's really difficult. And mm-hmm. I mean, he obviously has this stuff. His K percentage is crazy, but then his walk percentage is equally crazy.
Yeah, 23%.
Yeah, but then his K percentage is like 33%.
Yep.
I you can go through the whole thing. It's just, you know, I was looking at his pitcher level stats, and or pitch level stats, and they would be through the roof if he could command the pitches. I know that like the numbers are lower simply because of command, not because of like quality of stuff. I mean, it's just,
oh no, his stuff is insane.
Yeah.
It's just like, I don't know if he is capable of commanding his pitches.
Right.
I just don't, I like, this is who he's been. So,
right. Right.
I don't know if he has the capability of being someone who can go 7 innings in a game or 8 innings in a game. That's why I think probably in a shorter stint may serve him best. But I think you're definitely right. I think the Yankees, especially like this early in the season, you just have to let him go and hope he somehow figures it out because of how ridiculous his stuff is. Like you give him as long of a leash as you want in the rotation, because you know that is ultimately what's most valuable. And again, if he can figure it out, then you have something really special.
Yeah, Hill is one of those examples, and for me, rare examples where sheer talent deserves giving that person as many chances as you need to give that person. You know, mm-hmm. I think sometimes people fall into the trap of someone's alluring talent and give too much leeway or give too many opportunities, and it's clearly not working out. But I think with Hill, I think he's one of those exceptions to my rule, at least, that you give him that leash and see what you can get, because you've seen instances where when he does have command, nobody's hitting him. I mean, it's not like every single time he's gone out there, he's just been totally reckless with his command. There have been starts where it's been better than the Toronto series, and he's super effective, and he's just striking guys out left and right. You know, guys just don't have a shot. So, yeah, I mean, I think you, especially as your fifth starter, and when Cole comes back, I think that's even more of a luxury to see what he can do in the rotation every 5 or 6 days or however they're going to play this out when Cole comes back. But, yeah, I think Toronto, man, maybe he learns from Toronto. I mean, I'm not sure what there's much to learn from that start other than throw strikes, other than the very obvious. But we'll see how he bounces back in his next start. I think he faces the Rays, right? Is he returned for the Rays?
Yep.
So that'll be a good test too, against some of their hitters. So one more pitcher we wanted to talk about, Carlos Rodon. He's someone that we've discussed in previous episodes. And is he having a good start to the season? Like, Rodon kind of feels like the offense to me in a way where it's like there's some good, there's some bad, there's some room to improve. I'm not totally sure what to make of Rodon. He's certainly been better than last year because the bar was on the ground if you use last year. So he's obviously been an improvement. But if we're looking at the expectations of a number two starter behind Cole and being somebody that you think could just like dominate a game, I haven't seen it. And that's not to say that he hasn't pitched well or that he's like a concern. So I don't want this to come across like I'm like dumping on him or saying he hasn't been productive, but I also don't feel like he's been like that top end of the rotation guy yet.
No, to start he hasn't. The season. Yeah. I mean, he definitely hasn't. You know, the raw numbers, you know, if you're just looking at those, it's like, oh, okay. Like he's got a 3.6 ERA. Like, no, oh, that's pretty good. Like that's what you want. But like, if you're looking deeper at it, like there are some like concerns. You know, I think number one with him specifically, he just doesn't strike people out anymore. And it's very strange because he was one of the best strikeout pitchers in the sport with the Giants. You know, he was mowing down hitters. I think he led the league actually in like Ks per nine in 21 with the Giants. Don't quote me on that, but he was up there. And he was a National League Cy Young contender both of his years with the Giants. He's just not that pitcher anymore. You know, we saw it in this start against the Blue Jays. They just kept fouling pitches off. Bo Bichette, I think, had a 12-pitch walk. George Springer, I think, had a 10-pitch walk. He just I don't know if his stuff has like diminished, because like if you look at the stuff plus numbers, like they're still fine, but right. I just don't think the effectiveness of his pitches are the same anymore. You know, it was death by the fastball. I think that's what he said, or Boone said, after his start against Toronto. But, you know, one way to not have your death come because of a foul ball, death of a foul ball, is because of the fact that just have better put away pitches. And he just doesn't right. have that right now. You know, he's in the 34th percentile in strikeout percentage, 25th percentile in whiff percentage. He just doesn't have any swing and miss right now. And, you know, I think what's concerning too is, they're opposing hitters are hitting his fastball even better than what they were last year. 319 yep. average against his fastball. And his fastball last year was bad. It was horrific. I think that's probably partly why he, you know, decided that he needed a few more secondary pitches. You know, we talked about his cutter after the Marlins series. You know, he's been using his changeup. He really likes the get me over curveball for a first pitch strike. You know, he's going to those pitches more often this year, maybe because, you know, he feels like his fastball and slider, his two best pitches, just aren't the same. But, you know, we're in year two of a 6-year contract. You know, we still got a long way to go with Carlos. And right now, you know, if it's looking like this now in year two, what is it going to look like in year five?
Right.
Year four. I don't know. Like he's definitely better than last year, but you know, like you said, the bar was on the damn ground. Like right. it's hard to be worse, but yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens with Carlos in the years ahead, because right now I don't think he's like their second best. He's not their second best starter right now. That's Stroman. Right. Stroman's number one, but you know, when Cole's healthy, obviously Cole's one. But even still, like, I don't know if you can trust him to like be that guy that you need him to be in the playoffs. I just don't see it.
So I'm on pitcher list and I'm looking at Carlos Rodon's pitch profiles over the years and this year, and his usage across his repertoire. And this is a quick glance as we're having this conversation. And I'm not Matt Blake. I'm not professing to be Matt Blake. I let the professionals do what the professionals do. But numbers can tell you some things. And looking at this quickly, it feels like he should use his slider more. And his cutter usage and his slider usage are pretty close to one another. And he's throwing his fastball close to 60% of the time. Obviously, he's going to be a predominantly four-seam fastball guy. So that's who he is. He's not going to go away from it, nor should he. But he's not really using his slider as much as I thought he would and has in the past. And he's not getting as much swing and miss on it. And I feel like if we're talking about Rodon figuring out a way to get more swing and miss, he probably should lean on that slider a little bit more, because it is a good pitch for him and it's been performing pretty well. It's just that I don't think he's using it enough in situations where he can put somebody away. And maybe there's such a emphasis on getting away from him being a two-pitch pitcher that he's kind of shied away from the usage of that slider. And it's still his second-best pitch. So I'm curious if, as the season goes on, the Yankees look at some of the numbers and go through like what he's doing and maybe suggest using a slider a little bit more, at least in situations where he can kind of get a strikeout, or if he needs to get some more swing and miss, that the slider like plays a little bit more role, because the slider usage and the cutter usage are close to one another. He's throwing a slider a little bit more, but just briefly looking at it, I mean, he's he's not using it as much as he has in the past, and he's not he's getting more, like, his strike percentage is good, but I think that his ozone percentage has dropped. But I think part of that's just, like, the usage. You know what I mean? Because the pitch is actually performing well. So I'm curious if one way to, like, address it is just to throw more sliders, kind of like how the Yankees offense needs to swing the bat more. Maybe he just needs to up the usage a little bit to, you know, so, and also it's just a different look. I mean, the cutter and the fastball kind of, they're not obviously the same pitch, but kind of have the same kind of trajectory to a certain degree. But then you have the slider in there to kind of just, like, you know, bury in the right-hander's back foot or whatever. So I'm curious if the slider usage goes up as time goes on to kind of help him out a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at it now. In 23, he threw a slider 28.9% of the time. This year, it's down to 18.5. There has to be a reason for it.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm at the stadium tomorrow, I definitely plan on asking Matt Blake about it. You know, his whiff percentage on his slider, if I don't, it just got away from it. I think it was like 36.8% whiff percentage on his slider. It's really good.
Yeah.
Strikeout percentage 33.3, but there has to be a reason why Carlos and the Yankees have obviously decided that he needs to throw his slider less often. I don't think that just came out of thin air. Like, there has to be a reason. There has to be a reason why that happened. You know, obviously they decided that he needed a cutter to, you know, get in on righties and, you know, put the ball on the ground. You know, that's been fine for sure. But, you know, for his career, he's been a two pitch pitcher. So there has to be a reason why he's gone away from his slider.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's still an effective pitch, and, you know, we're obviously not pitching coaches for the New York Yankees, so not suggesting anything. But it feels like the numbers are telling us that that might be something that can help a little bit with the swing or miss. So we're going to wrap this up. Another episode this week. Again, thank you for supporting us. We really appreciate it. We appreciate all the feedback and support that you guys have been giving us. Chris, any final words on this Yankees off day and the terrible weather outside?
No, I'm looking forward to Saturday, though. You know.
Oh, yeah. We should talk about that. Yeah.
John Sterling deserves all the shine that he's been getting over these past few days. I'm 31 years old. I don't know any other radio broadcaster other than Sterling. And, you know, there's obviously so many Yankee fans my age or around my age who are in the same boat. Like, that was it. Like, you know, I remember, you know, growing up here in the Bronx, you know, drive around town. My dad's a huge Yankees fan. Always, you know, always listen to the radio, and Sterling would be the voice. That's the only voice I've known. So I do hope that the Yankees honor him the way he should be. Like, he definitely should have something in Monument Park. He's a legend. Yeah. You know, he should have some plaque or something. And he also deserves to be in Cooperstown. I can't believe that he's not already enshrined in the Hall of Fame. I think that's crazy. You know, some people feel, you know, I feel like there's a lot of people on one end of the spectrum and the other end of the spectrum with John. You know, some people find his antics to be annoying, the calls to be annoying, especially in his later years. Like, he would get a lot of calls wrong. You know, he's 85 years old, though. We have to remember that. So I think for him, like, Brendan and I have a story coming out in The Athletic where we talked to a couple of people, and Sweeney Murdy, who worked at WFAN, said it best. You know, Vin Scully is definitely the best baseball broadcaster to ever live. Mm-hmm. Hands down. No questions asked. He's the best baseball broadcaster ever. But, you know, if you're a kid in your backyard, you can't do Vin Scully calls. Like Vince Scully's right. telling stories, but you right. can do John Sterling calls. You can, you know, come up with different home run sayings and all that for your friends. Like you, like he's has to be one of the most imitated broadcasters out there just because of his style. And that says a lot about just his legacy. And I do hope that, you know, he is celebrated. You know, I feel like Yankee fans, especially some Yankee fans, definitely got onto him in these past few years. But he definitely deserves all of the respect that he has earned.
Yeah, I echo every single word that you said. I love John Sterling. As a Yankees fan, I greatly appreciate him. I had the honor of meeting him when we did the captain, when we interviewed him, and he was one of the nicest people I've ever met. Incredibly charming and engaging and funny, and didn't take himself seriously, which I also appreciated as someone who's legendary and has this aura around him and this stature. For someone that was so self-deprecating and so self-aware, was just really refreshing to be around, especially in the time that we were filming the captain with the pandemic still going on. And just a very kind man. And as someone that listened to him for the majority of my life, I just appreciate him. And I think the biggest compliment I could give him is that he didn't have any fear being his authentic self. Like, he is who he is, and he presented himself that way, whether you liked it or not, whether you appreciate it or not. John Sterling was going to give you John Sterling. And I think for someone to do that, especially as a broadcaster and a broadcaster for a brand as big as the New York Yankees, it just, in my opinion, tells you everything about the person. And I think that far outweighs his incredible career as a broadcaster. And you bring up Vin Scully, and I think with John Sterling retiring, as a baseball fan, it makes me a little sad because I feel like the character of the baseball broadcaster is eroding. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean this necessarily as a shot to anyone, because there are a lot of broadcasters that I do enjoy. I'm a fan of Michael Kay. I know he gets flack for stuff, but I like Kay. And there are other broadcasters that I think have a definitive style. I think of Jason Benetti and Gary yep. Cohen and a couple others. Yep. But I think on the whole, the broadcaster as a character is going away. And I feel like there are a lot of people that sound the same, that approach it in the same manner, and for whatever reason, don't necessarily interject their true character or personality into their job. I think they just kind of play it safe for some. And John Sterling never did that. Neither does Susan Waldman. You know, mm-hmm. the both of them are who they are. And I think for me, that's what made the broadcast enjoyable, because these non sequiturs that they would have, or these theater references, or mm-hmm. these like movie references for films in the 1950s that maybe only film school students might know of at this point, was always like entertaining to me, you know, and it had like a certain flair. And I think that when you, baseball is the one sport where I think that's really appropriate. The other sports, you know, it's really about like the product on the field most of the time, but because they're local broadcasts, I feel like baseball allows you to have flair and to have personality to help the game move along. And I feel like we're losing that a little bit. And I think we're losing a little bit more with John Sterling. But to me, that's more of a testament to John than where the industry is at. So I think the Yankees will give him a great send off. I mean, they're great at all those ceremonies and
yes,
their first class across the board, but especially when they honor one of their own. So I think Saturday is going to be amazing, and there'll be bobbleheads, and there'll be John Sterling. So,
yeah, I mean, John is one of one. I think that's the best compliment you can give someone. Like you mentioned it, like, you know, sometimes TV announcers and radio announcers get caught up in like trying to do it like by the book, essentially. John, there was no book with John. Like he was going to do it his way. And that's what you appreciated about it. Like when you listen to him, like you just don't know what he's going to say.
Right.
You know, some people may not like that, but there's so much space to fill in a baseball broadcast. Think about how much time is in between pitches or a foul ball. Like you have to fill that space. And that was never an issue with John.
No.
So, you know, salute to him. I can't imagine doing something for as long as he's done it, you know, broadcasting over 5,000 straight Yankee games. I mean, that is just hard to even fathom. Like how many people in their day-to-day lives can say they've gone to work for 5,000 straight right. days? I don't think not me. Yeah. I don't have any interest in either. That.
No,
I have no interest in that. But, yeah. You know, he loved the Yankees. He loves the Yankees. He loves baseball. He loves radio. He loves broadcasting. He loves going to the stadium. So, you know, I admire just how much he loves his craft. And I think that's something that we can all take from John.
Yeah. Well said. Great way to end this episode. So thank you to John Sterling. Thank you to all of you for listening to the podcast. You can find us on all of your favorite podcast platforms. You can find us on YouTube with the same name. Please subscribe there as well. If you don't want to listen to the audio version, or if you just prefer to hear and see your podcast on YouTube, we are on there. Please subscribe. Please leave us a 5-star review, all that good stuff. And if there's any suggestions on what you would like to get out of the podcast, you can also tweet us at the Views account, Views from 314 Feet. So with that, thank you for listening. We will be back next week. We'll have a new episode on Tuesday, and we will speak to you next week.